There was a dramatic day of evidence at the inquiry on Friday after Arlene Foster admitted that she has never even read the legislation on RHI, despite standing up in Stormont and recommending it to the public of Northern Ireland. The former First Minister encouraged MLAs to vote for it, but nobody knew at the time that she didn't know the detail of what she was encouraging people to vote for. On Friday, when questioned in the inquiry about reading the actual details of the regulations, this is what she had to say.
Did you at any stage read the regulations yourself?
No, I didn't. So there's absolutely not. I didn't read the regulations.
Even when, and I know we're moving further on down the timeline here, but when it comes to the stage where you're moving a motion in the Assembly that the regulations be affirmatively approved, would you have read them at that stage?
No, I don't believe I would have read them at that stage. I probably read the explanatory note, but not the regulations in full.
Now, as we all know, the RHI inquiry has become one of the biggest political scandals to ever hit Northern Ireland, and it contributed to the government in Northern Ireland collapsing. So let's listen again to Arlene Foster telling us that she didn't read the regulations behind it.
Did you at any stage read the regulations yourself?
No, I didn't. So there's absolutely not. I didn't read the regulations.
Even when, and I know we're moving further on down the timeline here, but when it comes to the stage where you're moving a motion in the Assembly that the regulations be affirmatively approved, would you have read them at that stage?
No, I don't believe I would have read them at that stage. I probably read the explanatory note, but not the regulations in full.
Absolutely not. I did not read the regulations. Some people might be asking how a minister can recommend legislation without knowing exactly what's in it. For example, within the legislation, one of its deficiencies was that it did not adequately define useful heat. And that ended up meaning that it was more difficult to crack down on potentially fraudulent claims. So if you were relying on someone like Arlene Foster as a minister to look at a document and think, well, useful heat, we need to go in, we need to define what useful heat is, with her lawyer background, that didn't happen, and it couldn't have happened because she just didn't read it. There were more bombshells last week from the inquiry. Arlene Foster said that she relied on her special advisor, Andrew Crawford, to read expert reports on RHI and bring back concerns to her. Now, one of the key items was a consultant's report that could have identified the scheme's financial shortcomings. It was a technical report from consultants Cambridge Economic Policy Associates. You'll hear it being referred to as CEPA. And it cost you, the taxpayer, £100,000. Guess what? Arlene's special advisor, Andrew Crawford, well, he couldn't be bothered reading it.
You, the special advisor, did you ever read either the first CEPA report or the second CEPA report in June or the addendum in February 2012? Did you ever read any of those documents?
I have no recollection of reading any of those documents.
You never?
Certainly, if I read, I don't believe, and I'm confident we didn't get the first version or the final version, or the first
final
version,
draft.
Final draft.
Final draft.
In terms of the final version, if I read it and went through it, I have no doubt that I would have raised questions about it, because clearly it was at odds with what was in the submission.
Well, at some stage you will explain what happened to it. Was sent to you?
Yes, it was sent. I'm not denying that, but I do not have any recollection of going through in it, and I can only assume that I didn't go through it. If I did, it was only scantily. And at that stage, my mind was already set that we were going down an RHINI route, and I think it is my greatest regret in all of this that I didn't sit down and read that report, because I think if I did, clearly my advice to the minister would have been different, and I have no doubt at that stage the minister would have had major questions to ask.
So there in the first couple of minutes of this programme, you're being reminded of the following. Arlene Foster, she doesn't read the legislation around RHI that she is recommending to MLAs. She's standing up in Stormont and she's saying, I believe in this, but she'd never actually read it herself. she'd read the explanatory note. And then her special advisor, and the special advisor is there. You pay for these special advisors. They're there to read into the detail of reports. And this, it can be described as a key report. It was a technical report. It was key because it cost you £100,000. And the DUP special advisor, he couldn't be bothered reading that report either. We'll get your views on this today. 03030 80 55 55. Sir Patrick Coughlin, he really didn't hit and miss the wall on Friday. That's his voice that you can hear inquiring in to some of these people who are appearing in front of his inquiry. The issue of not taking meeting minutes came up once again, to the point where Sir Patrick Coughlin suggested that Arlene Foster's department was edging towards a dysfunctional department. Here's Sir Patrick Coughlin, chair of the inquiry, again.
And the guidance clearly says that it should be recorded by the department making the presentation to the meeting. Now, there are no notes or records of this. Does that not start to edge towards a dysfunctional department? If these are the two people you trusted, and one of them didn't read any of the detailed documentation, the other one comes to you with an explanation that involves additional information, but no notes are made of it. No inquiry is made as to whether notes are being made. And yet this is a unique project.
Well, I do have to say that I was somewhat taken aback that there were no notes of the meeting. I would have expected notes to have been, if not taken at the meeting, at least after the meeting, that there would have been some sort of record of what I had said at the meeting, what she had explained to me. That's why it is disappointing, because, of course, if we had those notes, there would be clarity around all of this.
Well, let's walk through this with the newsletter's Sam McBride. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
If we started at the beginning of what we brought to you there this morning, how can a minister stand before Stormont, before an assembly, and say, this is what I believe in, this legislation I want you to vote through, and she hadn't read it?
I think a lot of people will be very surprised about that. I mean, certainly as somebody who's covered Stormont for about a decade, my expectation would always have been, when the minister stands up and recommends legislation, that they have at the very least been walked through it line by line by their officials, if not having sat down themselves and done that separately. It certainly would never have crossed my mind that they were not across the detail of it. I suppose the very basic reason why I would have expected that is that the whole point of them coming to the Assembly is to ask the Assembly for approval. The Assembly has the power to not give approval. The Assembly has the power to ask for clarification on various points. If you haven't read it, it would seem difficult to know how you can do that. Now, there are officials who accompany the Minister to the Assembly. It may be that Arlene Foster was reliant on those people to pass her notes or something like that if there was a query raised. But really, in the context of what we now know, I was not only surprised that she hadn't read it, but the clarity with which she said she hadn't read it, because on many occasions when Arlene Foster was before the inquiry on Friday, she was saying, I can't remember, I'm not sure, I can't recall, I don't have a clear recollection. On this, she was very clear. She said, no, absolutely, I did not read it, which I suppose raises a second question, which is not for the inquiry, but which goes beyond its terms. Did she read other legislation which she brought before the Assembly? Did other Stormont ministers read legislation before they brought it before the Assembly? Or was this just the way the system operated?
Sam, the DUP and indeed Arlene Foster, they've held the line for many, many months now that they don't feel. Well, Arlene Foster has said in the inquiry that while she regrets this has happened, she doesn't think that she has made any personal mistakes. How is it not a mistake? How is she standing over to this very day to the public of Northern Ireland that she doesn't need to read legislation that she recommends to us all? Like, is that her position?
Well, again,
I don't know what's in it, but please vote for it.
I think lots of people will be very surprised at that. I mean, it will ultimately be for the inquiry to decide whether that had any material impact, whether if she had read it, it would have made any difference. I think, as you pointed out earlier on, there is a particular surprise in the idea that Arlene Foster did not read the regulations which were coming to the Assembly, because while legislation is pretty dry stuff, but it's part of the role of a minister, Arlene Foster, of course, has a legal background. She is a trained lawyer. So if anyone could be expected to read legislation, one would have thought that a lawyer who happens to be a minister would be more likely to be across that level of the detail. What we seem to have here, I suppose, in a broader sense, when we step back and look at some of the evidence, is a minister who is very reliant on her officials, who places incredible trust in them and in her special advisor. And I suppose it would seem, based on what we know so far, that really gives incredible power to those officials, because if the Assembly is not doing its job properly by scrutinising this, which I think it's fair to say it didn't, it was a very quick debate, and it was passed unanimously without a formal vote. If the minister is not reading the legislation, if her advisor isn't reading the reports on which it is based, who actually controls the legislative process? Well, I think there's a very strong argument that officials have a much more significant role in that process than democratically they ought to have.
And I don't think we need to remind anybody in this country, but let's remind ourselves what the end game here was, that the government needed to then go in to court and argue for cost controls to be retrospectively applied here, for the public spend to be applied here, because at one stage, Sam, we were looking at a £700 million potential overspend. Now, what they did do was they went in, they got a court to agree that, look, that could be capped, and it's been capped this year again. But that's how important all of this stuff was.
It was certainly a very large overspend. I think there's some debate as to exactly what it was, and that's still up for that's really before the courts, I suppose, to a certain extent. There's an appeal of that judgment, but nobody disputes that it was many, many millions of pounds. It was very significant, and it was significant enough that the Stormont executive ultimately had to bring a DUP minister, Simon Hamilton, had to bring to the Assembly legislation which effectively changed this legislation, which Arlene Foster had not read. So that was how significant it was.
And so whether it was, you know, 2 million, 10 million, 400 million, 700 million, all of that, yeah, you're right, up for debate. At the end of the day, this resulted in an overspend. It is with that context then that we move to point two, which is that Arlene Foster's special advisor, Andrew Crawford, who is still employed by the DUP, he's the man who inappropriately tipped off his relatives, two of his relatives, about the scheme. There's a £100,000 report that the public has paid for, and he can't be bothered reading it. It's his job to read it. He just didn't read it, Sam. Are you there, Sam?
Yes, hello. Sorry, I just lost you there.
Okay. So I was saying Andrew Crawford, he's Arlene Foster's special advisor. There's a £100,000 report that the public has paid for into SEPA, and he just can't be bothered reading it. All right. Obviously, we've just lost Sam McBride there. Let's see if we can get him back in a moment or two. We'll bring in Richard and Dundonald. Morning to you, Richard.
Good morning, Stephen.
Morning. Go ahead, Richard. We'll get Sam back in a second or two.
I don't know what we're really worried about.
Richard, actually, stay there, because I want to walk through this with Sam, and then I promise I'll come to you, if you don't mind, because we can do this in sequence. Sam, you're back with us.
I am, yes.
Right. Good. I was saying that Andrew Crawford, Arlene Foster's special advisor, there's a report from consultants Cambridge Economic Policy Associates. It cost the public £100,000, and he couldn't be bothered reading that.
Yes, and this report is something which the inquiry has heard a lot of alpha evidence on from the officials who were involved in it, and before it would have come before the special advisor. And one of the things to emerge from that is that there were such basic errors in this at various points that really the inquiry panel was pretty incredulous that somebody would not have picked those up if they had read through it. Now, it's true that they weren't picked up. The officials say that they really placed a lot of weight by the expertise of these, or the supposed expertise of these, the private consultants. And so it sealed through the system to the point where it got to the special advisor. But I suppose the question then is, if he had read it as somebody who was a little bit removed from that process, who had a degree of expertise in scrutinising government policy papers, etc., would he perhaps have picked up on this? None of us can know that, but certainly in the position of somebody who is a specialist advisor to the minister, and really from a political point of view, let's not forget that one of his functions is to protect his minister, so he's there to ensure that she doesn't get into this sort of a situation where people are saying, why did you not know this? Why did you let this happen? Were you not across the detail? That's really part of his role. So I think even from the perspective of the DUP, there is an element here that one would expect that he would certainly be taking a big interest in this. But again, as we heard there, he either couldn't quite clearly remember or tended to think that he hadn't read this.
They didn't, of course, tell us any of this at the time, Sam, when the scandal was in full flow, that Arlene hadn't read the legislation, that Andrew Crawford hadn't read the SEPA report. We're only hearing this now.
Well, I think that is in many ways the value of a public inquiry, that it is held in public. We get to hear the evidence. There is, for people who are cynical about the Stormont system, there is no chance of this being covered up in any way. We get to hear it line by line, piece by piece. And while the inquiry will ultimately come and report and give us their view on it, we get to hear the evidence. We get to form, as the public, our own view on what we have heard. And I think there is a degree to which this goes far beyond, as we've discussed before, the RHI issue. It goes probably even beyond the DUP. It goes into the entire Stormont system. And perhaps that's one of the reasons why both the DUP and Sinn Féin were initially, for weeks, very, very reluctant about going down this route of a public inquiry where we would get to hear the evidence in the way that we're now hearing it.
Another thing we learned from the inquiry, well, we knew this from some of the paperwork we had seen, but it's when you hear it talked about in the context of an inquiry, it maybe hits home, Sam. So there was a similar scheme, a similar RHI scheme in Great Britain, okay? And that was in operation. And some within 6 months of going into that scheme, they were consulting on digression. Within 6 months of it being set up. Do you want to explain to people what digression is, first of all?
Yes, in the simple terms, it's a form of cost control, so it's a way in which to control the budget. So as the budget is depleted, there is a mechanism whereby the subsidy level is cut to make it less attractive. So it's like two ends of a seesaw, I suppose. As one goes down, there is a correlation at the other end of the seesaw.
Okay. Now, remember that we didn't have those cost controls in Northern Ireland. That's one of the fundamental errors, with the benefit of hindsight, in the scheme. There were no cost controls. So with that context, have a listen to Sir Patrick Coughlan, Chair of the Inquiry, talking to Arlene Foster last week.
In terms of the Northern Ireland RHI scheme, I can't recall any burning issue around cost controls being raised with me.
Whether it was a burning issue or not, if you're getting advice from your equivalent minister in GB to say, this is what we are doing, within
yes.
6 months of the scheme coming live, we're also about to consult on digression. Mm-hmm. One would have thought that might have been something you would have raised with officials or perhaps your special advisor. Should we be doing something like this, or is this... So whatever way you look at it, you as a minister and the department were alerted to the fact of what was happening in GB.
Oh, I think that's yeah. correct.
So, Sam, how did we get to the point where Arlene Foster learns about cost controls in the GB scheme and, as Sir Patrick says, she doesn't think, do we need them here?
Well, it's very much in line with, I suppose, what Arlene Foster has said ever since the Spotlight programme in 2016, that she really did nothing wrong in this. She has, as you said earlier, repeated that at the inquiry last week. I suppose the question for the inquiry here is whether... I should add to that it is clear from the evidence in the early months of the inquiry that her officials certainly failed her in several key regards. They put before her some evidence that was misleading, evidence that was not accurate. I suppose the question that Sir Patrick is perhaps probing in those questions is whether it's enough for the minister to say my officials failed me in many regards by saying that we were able to press ahead without these cost controls, or does the minister also have some degree of responsibility there? Does her special advisor have a degree of responsibility?
Does the buck not ultimately stop at the minister?
Well, we get into, I suppose, a slightly semantic debate there as to whether she is responsible for what happens in her department or whether she's accountable for it. I mean, she's certainly accountable for it, but whether she is personally responsible for it, I think that's what they're trying to tease out in these questions. Was there enough put in front of you? This letter from the Whitehall minister saying, this is what we're doing in Britain, this is why we're doing it. Should that have caused her to be curious about what was going on, to question what her officials were saying, or was there a culture of the official said, and therefore that is what we do? Is that the role of the minister? I think that's a much wider debate that the inquiry is starting to get into here.
This was a brand new scheme in Northern Ireland, Sam. Brand new, and had risk associated with it because, one, it was brand new. And we're told that the equivalent scheme, similar scheme, in Great Britain has implemented cost controls. And no one, not Arlene Foster, not Andrew Crawford, none of the civil servants look at that and think, OK, we need to do the same here.
Well, that takes us to some evidence from David Stirling, which was raised with Arlene Foster. David Stirling was the head of Arlene Foster's Stormont department at the time in terms of the officials. He was the most senior civil servant there. He's now head of the civil service. In his evidence to the inquiry, he has suggested that there was a culture within Stormont whereby if the money came from the Treasury, that is, if it didn't come out of the Stormont budget, there was a culture whereby they wanted to spend as much of it as possible. And on one level, that's quite easy to understand. They're trying to get as much money into Northern Ireland. They're trying to stimulate the economy at a time where it's working and that and where the economy is coming out of a long recession, etc. But one of the things which he suggested was that therefore means that you're not necessarily incentivized to go for the cheapest scheme or the most value for money scheme. You're actually almost perversely incentivized to go for the most expensive scheme, because if you're trying to get as much money into Northern Ireland, do you actually want the scheme with cost control? Do you want the scheme that's cheaper, such as a grant scheme? Now, Arlene Foster was asked about this. She agreed that there was this culture of trying to get as much Treasury money into Northern Ireland as possible, but she then disagreed with David Stirling that the logical outworking of that was that you would not want a scheme that was cheap. You would want a scheme which was going to get the most money into Northern Ireland. So that is, again, one of the issues which is going to come back time and time.
I think Arlene Foster said, look, it's all public money. She would care no matter where the money was being spent,
right,
because it's public
That's
money,
right.
to That's be right. fair and to her.
That is what David Stirling said as well. I suppose they all caveat it by saying that, but it does seem that there was a slightly different mindset when it was money from one pot as opposed to from another pot. Arlene Foster was very clear, for instance, that if she had known at the outset that the way in which this was funded meant that it actually wasn't all Treasury money, as we now know, that there was going to be a potential implication for the Stormont budget, she said that would have been such a significant factor that she would have had to bring that to her colleagues on the executive. So there is a bit of a debate as to what the significance of that is, but it's certainly something which seems to have been in the system, if not with Arlene Foster, certainly with some of the civil servants.
There are others here, Sam, that we should be asking a question about, surely, because, again, to be fair to Arlene Foster, okay, we know that as a minister she didn't look at the regulations, that she, the legislation that she recommended. But there are committees in Stormont, and other parties have sight of rules and regulations, and that's supposed to be part of the process of scrutiny before something becomes legislation. How come none of them spotted any of the shortcomings here? All of these other political parties?
It's a very good question, and I think, again, it is where this takes us far beyond simply what the DUP did or what the civil service did. It's a systemic failure, and everybody in many ways failed. We can argue as to what the percentage of the level of failure in each case is, but there's clearly been failure at every level. The Stormont Committee, which was charged with scrutinising this, there has been evidence which shows that some of what went before it from the officials was not entirely accurate, as with Arlene Foster. But again, is that good enough? Is it not the role of a scrutiny committee to really press officials to ask difficult questions to get to the bottom of this? Certainly when it came before the Assembly, there was very little debate. If anything, what the MLAs in the non-DUP parties, if you like, were generally asking was, why are the subsidy levels not higher? So, I mean, I think there are very significant questions here, not just for Arlene Foster and for the civil service, but for the entire Assembly system. And one thing to bear in mind, this happened before there was a Stormont opposition. Would this have been different if those parties scrutinising it had not also been nominally at least part of the same government. Perhaps not, but I think that is that is something which hangs in the air to a certain extent.
So if just finally, Sam, if I sum up what's what and there's so much detail here, but if I sum up what's what I can remember that we've learnt over recent weeks, we have David Stirling, the head of the civil service, saying that there was a culture in Stormont of not writing things down so that the public could never find out about it if there was a freedom of information request, number one. Secondly, then, if we then focus on the RHI inquiry, we know that Arlene Foster and her special advisor, Andrew Crawford, were communicating in posted notes with each other. A disagreement between within that conversation about just what type of information was going down on the post-it note. That ranged in evidence to the inquiry from some people claiming that it was simply to say to Arlene, give me a call, and others suggesting that it was political messages that were being written in those post-it notes. From that, we now learn that £100,000 of public reports aren't even read by the special advisor, and the legislation that a minister standing up and recommending to the country she hasn't read. You start to ask, I think some people might start to ask, Sam, how capable is our government in Northern Ireland of pushing through legislation and making sure it's to the benefit of the public?
That's right, and I think it's actually far
it's bigger than RHI. That. This, in other words, isn't it?
Well, I think if you look 7 days ago, we were covering the 20th anniversary of the agreement, and we had Bill Clinton, we had George Mitchell, we had Tony Blair, we had all these people flying in and really imploring the local parties to get back into government to try to make it work again. I think to a certain extent, by the end of the week, with this evidence, what we have seen is the reality of how that government unfolded over recent years. We see a level of dysfunctionality, which is what Peter Robinson once quite openly talked about it being when he was the First Minister, and he had blamed the system for that. But regardless of where the blame for that lies, the system did not work in many cases. And I think we see in that one of the reasons why the public are not clamouring in terms of the support basis for the DUP or Sinn Féin. They're not pressing those parties to make big compromises to get back into Stormont, because when Stormont was there, they weren't really that fussed on it, or they thought it was actually a pretty poor place in terms of running Northern Ireland. So I think this, some people might ask, why does all this matter? Why does the RHI inquiry still matter? I think it's giving us an insight into how Stormont didn't work. And if Stormont does come back, I think it's pretty clear, or ought to be pretty clear to a lot of these people, that if it's going to work, there need to be pretty radical changes, both at official level and within how the political system scrutinises the work of those officials.
There's one thing I missed out from my recollection of events there. Andrew Crawford, special advisor, left his role as special advisor, still employed on a part-time basis by the DUP. It just strikes me that he couldn't be bothered reading the 100 grand report, but he did have the time to tip off some of his relatives about the scheme.
And that's again something which, I mean, he's back in front of the inquiry today. He's back tomorrow before Arlene Foster returns later in the week. He is perhaps not going to be asked in detail about that, because that's for a later phase of the inquiry, but it may be that that is touched upon in a wider sense. And I think one of the surprising things in this is not just that he did that he was being paid so much at that point, that he was meant to be protecting his minister, et cetera, et cetera, but that after he resigned, once it became clear that there was at least a series of allegations against him, which he denied last year, not only did he resign, but he came back into the party at some level at some point, but got a significant golden handshake from taxpayers at that point. I think some people will be surprised at the idea that in a Stormont system where you resign your post, you actually receive a huge payoff.
Yeah.
That's, I suppose, part of a wider culture and wider questions as to whether Stormont is looking after itself, or whether it's actually in touch with what ordinary people would expect in their jobs.
And if you're listening to today's programme and you didn't hear last week's programme, the man we're talking about, this special advisor, his name is Andrew Crawford. He's admitted not reading the report, essentially on your behalf and on behalf of his party, because his public money was paying for him as a special advisor. Despite the fact you paid 100 grand for that report, he couldn't be bothered reading it. When he resigned, you then paid him another £34,000. or as a severance package. Sam, I keep on saying final question. There's so much to talk about here, but this is the final question. Is the DUP in any way damaged by this evidence in your view so far, or has the public lost so much interest now in RHI that actually it won't matter to the DUP politically?
No, I think the DUP is very damaged by this. I think that there were some people, well, I know that there were some people within the DUP who thought that the months of evidence from civil servants where they had admitted or it had been really teased out of them that they had failed Arlene Foster in very significant ways. I think there was a degree of confidence among some people in the DUP that really it was something which had got better for them to a certain extent, that Arlene Foster was going in and almost the case had been made as to why she did what she did. And what we have learned here is something which I suppose to most people outside the Stormont system, and even I think to a lot of people who follow Stormont very closely, will have surprised if not shocked them. And I think it's difficult as well, I think, in a wider political context for Sinn Féin, who obviously were contemplating going back into government with Arlene Foster after initially saying that they wouldn't do that while the inquiry was ongoing. It makes it more difficult, I think, for them to now do that in the coming months. Unless this inquiry has conclusively finished and has reported. And that, I suppose, adds to the sense that Stormont, if it does come back, is not coming back this year, and potentially next year, potentially the year after. But really, this is now one of the significant stumbling blocks, I suppose, and it's certainly not the only one, but it makes it much more difficult for Sinn Féin to cut a deal with Arlene Foster while she's the DUP leader.
Sam McBride from The Newsletter, thank you very much indeed.